Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, we're reimagining Ireland and looking at the role technology can play in the mobility of our cities. Plus, designer Sharon Hoey talks to me about bringing her business online during a pandemic. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. But we're going to start this week with that notion of reimagining Ireland, which we've been talking about quite a bit here on News Talk recently. I'm joined on the line now by Dahi de Butler of Park Office and Will O'Brien of Zip Mobility to talk through some of the changes that we've seen and potentially what could happen to make the most of the space that we have. You're both very welcome to the show. Will, can you start by giving us a bit of an overview of what you've seen in terms of people looking for alternative solutions, technological solutions to get moving again, both pre and during COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. So our company, Zip Mobility, we're Ireland's leading shared micromobility provider. So what we provide are sustainable, community-centric shared e-scooter and e-bike schemes in cities across Europe. And what we've seen really at a policy level, specifically in the UK in reaction to COVID, is a need for diversification in transport to provide these alternative modes. You know, there was a strong sense when COVID came on that public transport might be the safest place to do your daily commute anymore. And rightly so, the data suggests that it can be, a source of COVID-19 transmission. So they moved to legislate for e-scooters. And as a result, we've secured contracts with a number of local authorities there. And these local authorities are looking to put in alternative modes of transport for their citizens to move both kind of safely, but also in a climate-friendly manner as well. Obviously, electric scooters, electric vehicles are reducing our emissions and reducing cities' carbon footprints. So we've seen that. We've had these schemes running throughout COVID-19 and through lockdowns, and we've seen consistent usage. It's been very interesting to note where they've been used as well. We see real hotspots of usage around places like hospitals and schools. And so the people that are still moving during COVID are looking for alternatives in micromobility, and the shared e-scooters in particular is one mode that has been quite popular throughout all of this.
Yeah, it's interesting because pre-pandemic, there was a lot of focus on e-scooters in particular from an environmental point of view. And I suppose the notion of carpooling was becoming popular too. But now we've been forced to sort of reimagine how everything is done. Dahi, just remind us what it is that you guys do.
Yeah, so Park Office is the world's leading parking software for smart offices. So in essence, we work with companies to optimize, understand, and ultimately eliminate employee parking. So I suppose we have a whole range of solutions there, depending on kind of company size. But our most popular kind of solution would kind of, equate to hot desking for parking spaces. So as you kind of said, pre-COVID, there was a large, to be honest, if I was honest, there was a large discourse around the need to move away from the car, but we were probably seeing a very different reality on the ground, in that companies weren't actually looking to eliminate parking, they were actually looking to increase. But one of the really interesting things that's kind of come out of COVID is that's gone full 360, or sorry, full 180 for a lot of companies. And now they are aggressively trying to reduce the amount of employee parking at work. And I think that probably comes from their own needs. And so probably pre-COVID, they had a lot of people traveling to work on a daily basis who were given out that their commute wasn't easy enough, and they were potentially looking at other options and other employment options as a result. Whereas now, I think, and we're working with a lot of companies in economies such as Australia and America, who are probably slightly ahead of Ireland in the return to office. And what you're seeing is you're seeing people going to the office for 2-3 days a week. And the challenge isn't so much about getting more space now. The challenge is how do we optimize people into the existing amount of space, and how do we work out where there's oversupply and eliminate that?
Yeah, and that is something that I wonder about quite a bit in general. You know, I live in an apartment block and we have a car space, but we never really use it because neither of us drive. And I often look down at it and just wonder, you know, that's a, like, we live in a busy part of Leopardstown. Could that space be utilised better or for something else? But we do need to be smart about it. But I suppose that's the kind of thought process that we're looking to talk out. So if you are a company that has X amount of car spaces, or if you're a corporation, a city corporation, and you have X amount of car spaces, how do you make the most of it? And at what level does this planning happen? Like, what are the different chess pieces that need to be moved?
Yeah, so I suppose it depends on the market that you're operating in. So, for example, if you are a large scale employer in a big city in America, you probably take part in what's called a transport demand management process, which in essence, that's like transport quotas. So the big companies sit down with the local councils and they say, they basically agree targets on a 2 or 3 year cycle of how many people and are going to be allowed to drive to their office on a daily basis, and how many people are going to cycle, walk, take scooters or whatever. And they're actually fined if they don't hit them targets. Whereas, so you'll see in some of those markets that a lot of this sort of stuff is, to be honest, it's much more advanced than where we're here at the moment. But I think the Irish market is moving in that direction, and COVID has definitely accelerated that. But in the long term, I think there is a bigger question of what's going to happen with all these empty parking spaces. I know, you know, Uber and people like that would like to have you think that parking isn't going to be a thing when autonomous vehicles take over. But if you actually look at the kind of leading academics in the space who don't necessarily have a commercial interest, they'll tell you that there will always be a need for car parks. Now, there'll be a need for much less because the automated cars will be able to park with 80% extra efficiency, but they'll still need to go somewhere. But it is still going to free up a massive amount of space. And I think before COVID, that the conversation was, oh, sure, we'll be able to use them to build office and apartment blocks. But now there's a massive question on whether people are going to want the same level of offices and apartment blocks in city centres. So that does raise massive questions. There's some real cool stuff you can do in that space too. Like, for example, I've seen some stuff in the States where, you know, car parks, an office car park is only in use really from 9 till 6 in a lot of places. So what they've actually done is they're putting down special surfacing so that they can be used as kind of like AstroTurf football pitches in the evening for local sports clubs. And I think we'll probably end up in a space, in a place where we have this really kind of hybrid use of space where a car park isn't full for 8 hours of the day and empty for another 16. A car park will be massively reduced in size. Technology will be optimizing its use to make sure that only the total necessary amount of cars are parking in there. But then that the rest of that space will be used for community use or will be put to other uses. And I think that's going to unlock a very exciting land bank for cities all over the world. So it's going to be interesting to see really what happens with it, you know?
I might piggyback on that and give some insight into some of the things we've been doing in some of our schemes, our shared e-scooter schemes. So the way we operate our shared e-scooter schemes is we primarily operate on a virtual parking bay model. So we don't allow our users to kind of just start or end a ride wherever they'd like in the city. They have to park in specified parking zones. This is to control the kind of widely known vehicle litter problem people see in the scooter sharing industry, where these scooters kind of get strewn about the place. But one thing we're doing now is like working with car park providers to take you know, a space or two off their hands in car parks and moving away from car parks as a kind of single use. They're just for cars, and looking to make them kind of more multimodal. And then this multimodal shift and shift away from just it being a car park to more of a kind of a mobility hub, I think, is really where we'll see transport going. The integration of public transport with private transport to really get these fully integrated end-to-end transport solutions to eventually, you know, accelerate us to where we want to go, which is a reduced reliance on private vehicles and reducing the carbon emissions that are emitted each year from transport. You know, it's the number one contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in the world. So this is somewhere we need to go. And even on our own doorstep here in Dublin, Fingal County Council have been doing some very interesting work on mobility hubs. So I think that's another interesting use case as well for car parks, is trending towards kind of mobility hubs rather than just being a place for your private car to sit for 8 hours a day.
I want to go back to the point on sort of reimagining it in just a minute, but I want to pick up on something else Dahi said there in relation to autonomous vehicles. These are, of course, the driverless cars, which we know are coming. But what I want to talk about is legislation, because we're a while away from the law catching up to technology. We've seen great innovation in terms of e-scooters, but my fear is that all this technology and the potential of it is not going to be optimized, because it's something new, it's something different, and that can be a bit scary or daunting in the eyes of the people who are in power and the people who create this legislation. You know, they may not adapt quickly enough for us to embrace it and make the impact from a lifestyle point of view or an environmental point of view, or indeed a space point of view.
Absolutely, Jess, this is a great point. I think this is a very interesting thing you're seeing across technology, not just restricted to mobility. You're seeing it in data protection, artificial intelligence, all sorts of legislation. And legislation needs to be flexible to keep up to date, and you can do that. So, for example, we are looking like Ireland will legislate for e-scooters here in the coming months. On a European scale, we are a laggard. We are one of the last countries in the European Union to legislate for e-scooters, but it does seem like it is coming. And I think in order to do that, we need to be creative, and in order to be flexible in our legislation, we need to be creative in how we craft legislation. So it's making that, it's, you know, some parts of legislation have to be changed through the whole Dáil having to sign off on it, and other parts can just be done by ministerial order. And I think it's, you know, making the legislation for e-scooters and other rapidly changing areas of technology, making part of the legislation have to be passed by the wider Dáil, and then having other more nuanced parts of the legislation having to be then changed by ministerial order. For example, how this would happen is that, you know, for e-scooters, you would set something like the fines that maybe you might set for misuse, for the misuse of e-scooter. That would be a part of the primary and the core legislation, and that would have to be changed by the Dáil, and that might be set in stone for 10 years time. But then the more nuanced parts of the legislation, like the technology standards, so kind of what battery size is road legal in Ireland, or what wheel size for an electric scooter is legal, and what the technology requirements, they're the parts of the policy that are going to have to be a bit more flexible. So I think just with intelligent policy making in departments like the Department of Transport, I think we can get there and strike that balance between, you know, setting down robust legislation on things like safety, while also not inhibiting innovation.
All right, stay where we are, because we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, we will talk about what the future could look like and what needs to change to make that happen. Stay tuned.
Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address, or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. I'm still joined by Dahi de Butler of Park Office and Will O'Brien from Zip Mobility. We're talking about the future of mobility around the country. Dahi, I want to go back to what we were chatting about just before the break there in terms of reimagining and reusing our space and trying to get more out of our space. We know that councils around the country do a number of public consultations throughout the year. So they ask people, what would you like to see around the country and how would you like your cities to function? Do you think that we need to get more out of those consultations? And do we need to be a little bit maybe bolder and ballsier when it comes to what ideas we put forward?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. And I think I wouldn't envy anybody working inside the council at the moment, to be honest, because I just think that you come out with something with a bit of vision and you're just getting shot down left, right and centre. And a lot of people wouldn't agree with me, but to go to the whitewater rafting thing, there for me is the cover of A Lonely Planet Guide to Dublin, and an iconic image that can really help attract tourists into a space. But it gets kind of shot down. And that would be my worry around the reimagination of space. At the end of the day, there is always a need for brass tacks of housing, you know, and you wouldn't want to and be denying. And obviously we have a massive kind of homeless issue, and that is something that seems to have slightly improved through COVID. Why that is it's probably up for debate. But I just think, as someone who lived in Dublin city centre for 5-6 years, I'd be a bit worried about the future of the city, and I would have been pre-COVID. I think there is a risk that it kind of just turns into Disneyland for adult tourists. And I think doing things that is a bit cleverer and brings a bit more vibrancy to the space and makes it a bit more livable and attractive, not only for tourists, but for people who are living there day to day, I think is key. But I question whether there is sufficient scope for imagination, not necessarily for the leader, from the leaders in our local government, but actually from all the toxic detractors that are out there, to be honest with you, you know. And I think too often good ideas just get booed down in a chorus on Twitter, and that's the end of them. And that would be my real fear for a lot of the kind of a lot of our cities, really, you know.
Yeah, let's stick with that point, you know, of those who boo or give out on social media or on online forums. Well, like, this might break your heart now, but I've said before, when I was in Nashville, I didn't like the e-scooters everywhere. They were flying around the place. They were left thrown on, like, pavements and footpaths around the place. It was so frustrating, but there definitely are benefits to it. So how do we get the balance right in terms of, you know, how do we manage public perception of them and the public encounters with them? Because you're always going to have some idiot who's going to take the mic.
I think there's two things that jump out at me for managing that. And the first of all is strong legislation on the topic. And the second one is responsible operators of these shared services. So on the strong legislation, I think, you know, we need to look at where, to take scooter sharing, for example, right? We need to look at best practices. Part of the great benefit we have, I mean, it's not great that we've been waiting so long for e-scooter legislation in Ireland, but what we can, if we want to take an upside from it, we can look at it as an opportunity to look at what has worked elsewhere, and what are the problems experienced in other cities, in Nashville, in Paris, in Santa Monica. We've seen the problems related to the parking of e-scooters. So first of all, let's get that right in Dublin. Let's go for a virtual parking bay model, similar to how we have the Dublin bikes, but the technology is there now that you don't need to invest in infrastructure to keep these virtual parking systems. Paris reformed their parking bay model to from a dockless model to a virtual parking bay model. London will be doing the same, and Dublin should do that too. So that's what I mean by strong legislation. That's it on the parking issue as well. You know, giving police enforcement the ability to punish users for misuse is another strong point as well. In the UK, because e-scooters have been legislated in the same way cars are, you can get penalty points if you drink drive on your e-scooter, as daft as it sounds. There was actually someone on the Isle of Wight prosecuted for this very recently for drink driving. So treating scooters with strong legislation is how to start on that side. And then as well, on the flip side is the private sector component, is if Dublin City Council or Cork City Council are bringing shared e-scooter schemes into their locality, that they partner with responsible operators. And what is a responsible operator? Someone who isn't going to flood the city with scooters on day one, and someone who's going to work with local stakeholder groups. You know, the groups like the blind and the visually impaired are generally those most at threat from something like an e-scooter, and e-scooters is quiet and can be threatening to someone who doesn't have fully sighted. So for example, we're working with the guide dogs now at the moment to train every single guide dog in the country how to recognize a SIP e-scooter. So and our scooters are bright yellow with bright purple on them, and that contrast is really, really important for those who are partially sighted. So I think you know, a lot of it starts really at a local government and a national government level by getting these policy decisions right. And that kind of sets the framework, sets the groundwork for a successful move to new transport solutions in a way that respects both users and non-users of the service.
Dahi, sticking with the naysayers or the people who sort of find problems, What about the park office solution in terms of almost carpooling spaces? Like, what's the solution for those who would give out saying, well, I'm going to lose revenue if that space is shared or if it's opened up or, you know, if it's my space, I want to be able to come and go whenever I please. I don't want somebody else using that space. How do we win those people over?
Yeah, so it's an interesting point, and when we start, and it's something you hear a lot in Ireland, to be honest, and you don't really hear anywhere else. And I think I often wonder, is there historical reasons for it? And everybody knows the Irish attachment to land and lots of things that kind of come with that, and how that kind of shapes onto parking spaces can be interesting in people. It can get very territorial and parochial. But ultimately, I think everybody realizes that the world needs less parking spaces. And I think by and large, particularly with our system, when people can see how easy it is both to use the space, to share space, to claw back space, depending on your kind of rights and privileges within a company, that it totally alleviates any of those issues. So I know, for example, you know, when we started off, we were only working with, to be honest, companies with innovation at their core, so big technology companies and things like that, whereas now the kind of company we're getting in are very traditional. And in, I would say we are one of their first big SaaS purchases outside of kind of internal comms and accounting, which just kind of goes to show how open I think a lot of companies are becoming to these kind of concepts. But I think on a fundamental level, Jess, I think you'll struggle to find a company in the country or in the world who would say they think their car park has been run right. So I think that's a good place to start from, and people realize it needs to be done differently. And people also understand with difference and with change can come some teething issues. But put it this way, we've never had, like we've never lost a client who said, oh no, that's too difficult to use. But in a lot of sales, particularly with more traditional companies, that would be a concern for them starting off. But once they see how everything works, to be honest, those concerns are totally alleviated. And oftentimes, some of the most hesitant people become the biggest champions, both internally and for referring into other businesses in their network.
Okay, so let's finish where we all began, which is with the cliches of unprecedented times. Everything is a bit mad. We've been pushed to embrace different ways of working and so on. If we want to take the opportunity from this and so reimagine different ways of doing things in our cities, how do we go about evaluating and embracing some of the things that we've just spoken about now to ensure that real change is implemented? Will, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I think we have to realize, like, you know, as tragic as COVID has been for the entire humanity, we have to embrace it as a once in a century opportunity to radically rethink how we move. Transport is the number one contributor to greenhouse gas emissions worldwide. The next big crisis we're going to face post-COVID is climate change. And thinking about transport really intelligently and coming up with some real long-term sustainable solutions for changing how we move is imperative. So embracing new alternative modes of transport is going to be core to that. And we need to see that kind of at a policy level. And I think doing that, embracing it, bringing it into our towns and cities is how we can make our cities more livable in a world where and how we can see cities thrive in a world post-COVID where you can live anywhere you want because remote work is a new possibility. Cities are going to be under pressure to retain people in them. I know it's lovely and great to live in a city, but we need to make them livable again. And mobility and sustainable mobility is really at the core of that. We surveyed people of Dublin recently and asked them why they would use something like an e-scooter sharing service. And this is a piece of research we did with a professor in UCD, Professor Padraig Carroll. And the number one reason was convenience, fun. People enjoyed it. Inviting alternative mobility solutions into our towns and cities and taking this opportunity to go for a real green restart is, I think, how we can make the most of this.
Yeah, totally. I'm actually just, you know, to mention that, I to pick up on that again, I mentioned I have an e-scooter. I bought one a while ago, but I'm scared to use it at the moment because of the whole legislation cloudiness. But for me, the way I want to use it is not solely as my main device. I don't drive. I live on the Lewis line, but it would be great to, you know, hop off the Lewis if it's super busy and scoot the rest of the way, or just have the option to use the scooter when I'm out and about in my locality. So I do see the opportunity and the benefits. I just wish attitudes would change somewhat towards them. And I also wish that I had better guidance in terms of the rules of using it, just so I feel more secure. And I suppose, like, I don't want to really, you know, get arrested for just using an e-scooter around the place. So I do think as much clarity as possible would be beneficial. Where is a good place for us to start?
Yeah, so I think you've touched on an interesting point there, and before I kind of come into your question, which is, I think in the public discourse in Ireland, there seems to be a romanticism of micromobility as the only kind of solution. And I think from talking to people like Will and other people in the space, like, they'd be quite upfront in saying it has a massive role in solving these issues, but like, there's no one taking an e-scooter 20 kilometers, you know?
Yeah, it's not silver bullet.
And your point there, Jess, of the way that people use bike shared and scooter sharing and things like that is to finish journeys. So they're getting either public transport or they're driving, or potentially an e-bike, which, you know, they'll tell you it's around 8 to 10 kilometers is their kind of ideal journey size. But something has to do the heavy lifting on a journey to enable that kind of micro mobility. So I think, you know, at a governmental level, there probably is going to need to be more thought around what that can look like, and particularly with the new mobility patterns that are going to emerge. But I think that the big thing, and what's really interesting, is for the first time in a generation, there's a bottom line question here for businesses. And so previously there was a more, we need more parking or we're going to lose staff. And that's totally changed now. So for the first time ever, companies are looking at empty offices and empty car parks. And they're saying to themselves, well, hold on, do I really need 3 floors and 200 parking spaces anymore? And I think what you're going to see is, and we are seeing this anecdotally, is a lot of companies are looking at this as part of their return to office. And they realize that people are never going to travel to work and use offices the same way again. And they're looking to see what cost savings that can unlock for them. So while traditionally, I think we've looked at the whole area of transport as something for government to solve, I think increasingly we're going to see businesses step up and start to solve this for themselves, partially because it's good for communities and good for the environment, but mainly because it's actually going to save them money. And who in their right mind is going to be paying for, you know, 200 parking spaces that people, you know, that are fixed and designated to staff that are only in 2 and 3 days a week? It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, particularly in a place like Dublin, where you're probably paying $3,000 per space per year. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how things kind of change. But yeah, one thing I definitely think is we're going to see employers taking increasing responsibility. And I think that local governments right around the world are going to facilitate that as we move forward then, with stuff like the transport quotas that we've kind of mentioned.
Yeah, look, there's definitely a lot of work to be done, a lot of conversation to be had. And I would love to hear from you. What do you think? What would you like to see happen? Maybe you're the CEO of a company and you've made changes. You can email techtalk@newstalk.com. But for the moment, Dáithí de Butler and Will O'Brien, thank you so much for your time.
Margaret.
Thanks, Jessica. Margaret.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address if you'd like to get in touch with the show, or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. A quick reminder that you can subscribe to Tech Talk as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. If you just search for Tech Talk, hit subscribe. The latest episodes will land on your phone on Friday afternoon, usually around 12 o'clock, and it means you don't have to go looking for it, and you can listen to it whenever you like. Speaking of podcasts, this week is the final week of Future of Work Series 2, thanks to VHI Healthcare. This week's episode is all about management. So we have a brilliant conversation with the Irish Management Institute, all about the difference between a leader and a manager. They're not the same thing. very different characteristics and so on. But that was brilliant. But we also speak to David McRedmond from On Post. He's also involved in AIR and he's formerly of TV3. He's lived an incredibly interesting life. But he talks to us very specifically about his life as a manager. And in this clip, which I will play for you now, you can hear him talk through, I suppose, how he as a manager deals with letting people go, because obviously that's a very difficult position to be put in as a manager and indeed as an employee. But here's how he says he gets through it.
Oh, particularly when you know, you're first in management and you're more junior, that is literally the most horrendous and difficult piece. And if it's horrendous and difficult for you as a manager, it's much worse for the employee who you have to let go. And in a sense, it doesn't get easier. It does change. But, you know, at first, you follow all the rule books and make sure you do it very formally and properly and do those things as you should do. But to a degree, that can be slightly inhuman, as you're trying to do it properly and protect the company and do it legally right and all of that. I think as you get more senior and with more senior people, and I've been in both sides of it, I don't think anybody can get through a career without having to be on both sides, having to be moved on as well. I think what happens is you realize these are adult conversations. They're adult to adult conversations. We reach a point where we realize, you know what, I've probably done my job here and maybe somebody else can do a better job. And likewise, with somebody who works for you, you have those conversations. And so once you get to that point where you have enough confidence to be able to do that, without having to resort to the very strict rule book, you have a more human conversation and engagement. But, you know, it's never easy. However, you are doing it for the sake of the company, which is your obligation as a manager. Your obligation is to look after the company. But at the same time, you look after the person and you make sure you do it as decently as you possibly can, you know, and the test of that is whether you can remain in touch afterwards and whether, you know, I as I say, I've been on both sides of that and I'm in touch with people on both sides.
So that is David McRedmond of On Post speaking to myself and Gavin McLaughlin on this week's Future of Work with thanks to VHI Healthcare. You can listen to all 6 episodes of Series 2 wherever you get your podcast from. Back to this week's Tech Talk. As we know, and as we've spoken about here on News Talk many, many times over the last 12 or 13 months, so many different industries have been impacted in different ways as a result of COVID-19. I'm joined now by Sharon Hoey, who is a wedding dress designer. She has a beautiful bridal boutique, and she joins me now to talk through how she has kept her business innovative, I suppose, during this time. Sharon, you're very welcome to the show. Just start by telling us, I suppose, how badly you've been impacted over the last year or so.
Okay, well, I mean, it's been really very difficult. I'm sure, as you can imagine, you know, if you're getting married, there have been basically no weddings. We had a little bit of a break there during the summer when numbers went to 50 and we were allowed to have 50 at a wedding. So, you know, we were able to do, a lot of people went for that. But at the same time, we didn't know what was coming down the line. So you had people still holding on, you know, maybe till Christmas in the hope that they were going to get the 100 or the 180 again. So it's just been a year of unknowns. It's been really difficult for the business. I mean, in the whole of the, I think, 52 weeks we were open for, in the last 52 weeks we were open for 20. So, you know, that's a big hit, you know. And then, of course, we have to order our, you know, the dress. The girl comes in to view, just order her dress, you know, 9 to 6 months in advance. So a lot of people are getting married this summer who haven't even tried on a dress yet. So it's difficult.
Yeah, and it's and I know people who haven't, you know, gotten married or aren't engaged or aren't in this realm probably don't understand the full importance of the dress and also the ritual of going shopping for the dress as well. Like, it is a part of the process, and it's not like you can just go on to, you know, one of the fast fashion websites and just buy the first thing that you see. You have to try different styles. And so with the weddings that were sort of postponed, that's one thing. But anyone who's been engaged or planning their wedding for either this summer, next summer and beyond, they've also been impacted. So how have you managed to innovate to try and keep the wheels in motion?
Well, we have, we've just launched an online bridal store. So this is kind of really, I suppose, the first Irish designer bridal online store designed, imagined and made in Ireland. So we're not making our dresses in Portugal or in Europe or the Far East. We're actually making them here in Ireland. And we've kind of really looked at the whole process of buying the dress and what's involved and tried to bring as much of that as possible into the online space. So you can go online, you view the collection, then you can sort of say, right, well, I quite like the look of, you know, maybe two or three of these. You know, we go through the process, like, are you kind of having a more formal wedding, or do you prefer to kind of have a more fitted garment or a looser garment? You know, so there's sort of little guidelines there. We also, you know, unlike other online platforms, we actually encourage customer engagement. So we do encourage you to contact us, and we can do a call, you know, a consultation call with you and discuss what sort of styles you're looking at, as we're looking at the website, you're looking at the website, and then advise you that way. So that's quite good. The other thing, of course, is the fit, which is one of the things that most people are so worried about. So we've developed this toile service. So you can order, you know, you can sort of say, okay, look, I like that strapless dress, so I'll order a toile, which is a mock-up in cotton, very light. And we have a video on our website that shows you how to fit this. So you can say, right, well, you know what, this fits me, so I know I'm a size 10, so that's great. Or actually the top fits me, but the bottom doesn't. So therefore you could say order the separates. So, you know, we're trying to cover really all of the bases. And if you're unsure about the cloth, we're running a swatch service as well. So you can order the swatches and we'll send them out to you. So, you know, you can't do a couture service online, but, you know, you can still give a good experience, and you can still have a chat with, you know, either myself or the staff, and we will consult with you, you know, as we would if you were in the store.
What is the website, just for anybody listening now?
So it's our own website, www.sharonhoey.com, and the online collection is called Pretty in Pink. So you can go onto our website and then you just go into the menu and click down onto Pretty in Pink.
Okay, so that is, it's a great innovation. It's also something that, while it's been forced upon you, I suppose, with the pandemic, it is a useful tool that I think some people might appreciate over the years, the coming years. So say if somebody is coming home, or if they want you to do the dress but they can't necessarily get to meet you in person, there are opportunities. It's not all bad. It's not a negative.
Yeah, no. They could order the 12. But I mean, I'm not the first person, obviously, to do an online bridal store, to, you know, but people have been selling wedding dresses online, you know, like when the whole thing of online fashion started, you know, you had a lot of imports coming in and there was horror stories. And the old story goes, you know, if it looks like it's too good to be true, well, then it probably is too good to be true. So, I mean, you're not going to get a designer dress for 200 euros and it's going to be fabulous. It's not. So, you know, there are some designers out there who have been doing online wedding dresses well before this pandemic. And I guess for us, this was in the back of our minds as to how we can really enhance our business and what's the next stage that we can bring the business to. And I guess really for me personally, the pandemic has given me the time to actually do this, where, you know, in my normal, you know, working year, it's very busy and very packed, and I wouldn't have had the time to put into this. So that's the silver lining, I guess, for our business that's come out of this, is that we've had the time to do these collections, you know, which is great. And as you say, you know, for maybe some of our lovely diaspora living abroad who want to buy an Irish dress, you know, this is an ideal opportunity for them as well, you know.
I was listening to Down to Business here on News Talk a few weeks back, and Bobby was doing I think it was an interesting review of people who work in the wedding sector. And he had hoteliers, he had, you know, wedding planners, he had all kinds of everybody from the sector. And it was really stark listening to all those really talented people and people who go above and beyond to make people's special day perfect, being so badly impacted by the pandemic. Because as you said, if nobody's getting married, nobody's going to be booking hotels for 120 people. Nobody's going to be buying wedding dresses and veils and so on. Have you felt frustrated over the last few months as to, you know, some of the lack of guidance, perhaps, or some of the lack of clarity around the regulations when it comes to weddings?
Well, I do feel frustrated about the lack of clarity as to when we can get open on sort of with my business head on. With my, I suppose, my citizens head on, I understand totally that, you know, where the situation that we're in and the government and how hard it is for us, you know, we have to sort of stick it out unless we're going to be prepared to go through this for another 2 years. So we've got to kill it and we've got to get through with it. From the business side, we can't just be given a date sort of next week you can open. You know, there's a lot of planning involved. And, you know, I think it is a wedding industry. Our government do not accept that we are an industry. They don't recognise us as an industry. There was a recent survey done there by Tara Fay, the wedding planner. And I mean, the figures that came back were astounding. You know, we bring 2.3 billion, the wedding industry brings 2.3 billion into the country. And we're not recognised as a wedding industry. The events industry bring in 70 million. You know, they have, I think, their own nearly designated minister for it. You know, so mm-hmm. It's not there. I mean, people think weddings, they think fluffy, you know, they think it's fluffy, it's this, it's lovely, it's fluffy. It's not. It's business like everything else, you know. And from that side, yeah, I'm really frustrated that we don't have, that we don't have any guidance on where we're going. But I do understand that it is difficult and the situation that we're in is difficult. I am very thankful that we've had Chris, which has been a big help for us. And obviously before there's the EWSS as well, which has been very, very helpful. And I, you know, there is only so much that they can do. There are other industries, you know, connected with the wedding industry that haven't been able to get any help because they don't have premises, they don't pay rates or whatever. So, you know, it's even harder for them. But, you know, it is difficult. I would like us to be recognised, you know, for the industry that we are and for the contribution that we actually make to the country, you know, in terms of the money that is brought in.
Yeah, absolutely. As you look ahead to the future of your industry, you know, you've developed this brilliant innovation. As you said, other people in the industry around the world are doing similar. Do you think that we will return to normality whereby brides come in, try on the dresses, try on different styles, that sort of thing? Or do you think it's going to be a bit of a hybrid between the online and the in-store?
I think the younger generation coming up, our Gen Zs that are coming through who buy everything online, are not going to be as nervous about buying a wedding dress online. However, they will still want the experience, you know, so perhaps things may have to change a little in that you will become maybe a little bit more of a showroom. So people will come into you and try on, you give them the experience and perhaps then they order online. You know, now I haven't, as I'm speaking off the cuff here, you know, I haven't kind of thought this one completely through, but it's just as you're asking the question, you know, it is happening in other industries. So it is a possibility. Do I think weddings will sort of stay very small? Absolutely not. No, no, absolutely not. No. The bride, the Irish bride anyway, I know, you know, we love a big bash.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, it's been a pleasure to talk to you again. The website is sharonhoey.com. All of the information is there. Sharon, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Jess. Thanks. Good to talk to you.
And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full up on newstalk.com. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, Pocket Cast, the Newstalk app, or wherever you get your podcasts from. John Friday's up next here on Newstalk. I'll chat to you next week.